Is your team not performing well? Is morale low and turnover high? Are you falling further behind the competition? I'm here to help. I'm your host, Shaney, and this is the Leadership Show, where business strategy and culture finally meet, and we make the long-awaited shift from rhetoric to results. I promise I'm not your typical boring leadership consultant, and I will help you get your shift together. Let's do this. Good afternoon, Leadershifters. We are coming to you from Austin, Texas today, where I am here doing a leadership workshop all week. And why I think it's important to talk about the fact that I'm in Austin is because Austin is a food city, and this conference center, that I'm staying at, they are feeding us like the most delicious, rich, unique Tex-Mex amazing food. And today's guest is, you guessed it, someone from the food industry. This is Krista Lepore.
Hi.
Hi, everyone.
You guys are going to freaking love Krista, okay? So first of all, she is a restaurant guru. She's been in the industry for over 20 years.
A long time, yeah.
Yep. I know. At a certain point, we stop saying the years, don't we?
We start saying the years, yeah, a long time.
She's got a blog that blends dining and etiquette, and guess what? It's called Dinaquette. She was co-host of American Roadhouse a few years ago on the Travel Channel. Mm-hmm. Her current podcast is called Turning Tables. And she's also got a YouTube channel that you could tune into. How frequently?
Oh, it's weekly. It's weekly. Called National Food Holiday.
Excellent. And we're going to come back to the National Food Holiday thing because Chris and I were chatting offline before we started about some very interesting historical context about the different foods that become popular over time. So let's get into it.
Hi. I didn't know you were in Austin, by the way. I was just in Austin a month ago. You need to go to Magnolia Cafe because blueberry pancakes are life-changing.
It's amazing. Yeah. Totally amazing.
Life-changing blueberry pancakes. I've never had blueberry pancakes like that in my life.
Oh, and everything on their breakfast and brunch menu is over the top to die for.
I love that place.
Like if you only had a week left to live and you didn't care what you look like, you would just go have
go to Magnolia every day. Yeah.
100%.
Agreed.
you and I both live in New York, so we have that in common too. Where there's like, you know, the restaurant heaven on earth.
The Mecca, yes. Yeah. The Mecca of restaurants, yes.
So speaking of that, tell our Leadershifters, you know, a little bit more specifically what your background is and some of the cool shit restaurants that you have worked in and what your roles have been.
Yeah, sure. So I started working in restaurants when I was, in college, I think like most people do. And then once I graduated college and moved to New York and was pursuing actually a career in musical theater, I was a dancer. I would always wait tables and work in restaurants. And then as my body started to break on stage, I started to stay in restaurants more and more. And then it just sort of turned into the career. And then I have done literally every job at a restaurant in the front of the house possible. I actually even started at back of the house and then moved to front. Mm-hmm. So I've done every position possible. I have worked with top chefs, iron chefs, top chef masters. I've opened 3 high profile restaurants here in the city, worked at a bunch of Michelin stars. So I've been in the trenches and still am, actually. I still work in restaurants, sort of consult and go in and out and help open restaurants and do training and service and all of that.
Fabulous. Yep. I'll tell you, I went to France for a week last October to celebrate my birthday. I won't tell you which one. And went to a Michelin.
Clearly 21, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, well, yeah, clearly.
29. Went to a Michelin starred restaurant in Paris when we were there. And of course it was phenomenal and a fortune, but you know, worth every penny for like the most.
It's a mortgage payment, but sometimes it's worth it.
Absolutely worth it.
Yeah.
And then we went down to Provence and we were in this tiny little town called Tourette-sur-Loup, which no one, like most people in France, have never heard of. And it's a very, it's an old town. Like it's buildings carved into the stone. Like it's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years and it's become an artist colony and a lot of painters and jewelry makers and so forth. A charming little town.
That's nice.
They have a Michelin starred restaurant in this little bumfuck town and it was to die for.
Yeah.
And it was like €50 for the entire dinner.
Oh my God. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes.
So. Yeah. That beats the prices here. If you go to 11 Madison Park, I think, what is it? 300 a person right now. But that's with tip included. But I think it's like 300 or 400 per person, something like that.
Yep.
Michelin star. Yeah. So
yep, it's crazy. So, you know, you don't have to just be a New Yorker or, you know, in Austin, Texas, to know how important restaurants have become in our daily lives. And, you know, we were talking how it wasn't long ago that celebrity chefs have replaced rock stars in our, you know, in you know, sort of our esteem, and we chase them, and we can't wait to get a reservation at the hottest new restaurant by XYZ chef. And so, you know, there's a culture around restaurants, and that culture is constantly changing. And this is one of the reasons that I wanted to have Krista on the podcast, because Leadershifters, obviously, you know, that one of my big messages is, if you're not changing and shifting with the times, you're going to be obsolete, and you got to constantly have your finger on the pulse of what your customers are doing. So talk to us about some of the trends you've seen in your years and the shifts you've seen in restaurants, and how people responded to them successfully and others maybe not so successfully.
Right. So the interesting thing in hospitality is, at the end of the day, it's about the guest experience, right?
Yes.
So we want your business. We, you know, especially, you know, we were talking about New York. There's, you know, there's like 75 restaurants in one block or something. So you really are competing for business, right? So we want your business, but you still have to have a very specific point of view of what your restaurant is, what you offer, what you do. And there is, like, for example, I used to work for Chef Missy Robbins, and who's a James Beard award-winning chef. And she had an Italian restaurant, and a gentleman came in, and he's like, you know what? I'm kind of in the mood for chicken parmesan. That's not what this Michelin star chef does. And he was like, can you go ask her to do it for me? And I was like, oh, I can ask her. I know what the answer is going to be, but I'll ask her. And so I walked into the kitchen. I was like, chef. And then I said, you know, I have a guest who would love chicken parmesan. And she was like, great. Tell me Olive Garden is down the street. So I was like, okay, I don't think I'm going to tell him that, chef, but okay. So, you know, as much as we want your business there, you have to kind of know your audience a little bit, right? You as a diner have to know where you're dining, and then the restaurant themselves has to really let the guest guide their experience, which is really important. So in an issue like that, he has to understand he's in a Michelin star restaurant. When a chef creates a dish, when you go to a chef-driven restaurant, the dish is like a Broadway show. It's like a score of a Broadway show. Wow. Every note is there for a reason. And so if you take a component out or try and change things, it ruins their vision and their art. And that's why maybe you can't get things that are not on the menu. On the flip side of that, when you're dining out in general nowadays, one of the trends is what I like to call gender neutral service.
Okay.
You know, I think classically, especially in French restaurants, but classically in fine dining, the women get served first. That's really no longer the trend. Now it really is neutral service, gender service. And so the way I train and coach front of the house staff on this is when they go to the table to take the order, and so instead of saying, ladies, would you like to start, which is what normally happens, you would say, so who would like to start? You let the guest decide. You let the guest dictate how they're going to have their experience. You okay? Are you dying on me?
My allergies.
In Austin?
my spring, like, weather allergies have been killing me. And they kind of come and go. Yep.
So that's what we do. So it's best to let the guest dictate, because there are times the guest will say, please start with the ladies. And if the guest says that to you, that's what you do. But you always, as the server, as the captain, as the bartender, can make the effort to start out the conversation by saying, who would like to start first?
Yeah, for sure.
And this way you can dictate how it goes, because you really, you shouldn't assume someone's male or female.
Right.
And you shouldn't assume, because of whatever gender they are, whatever gender they identify with, that that's who should go first, because that's how it was dictated by someone a million years ago.
Right, in like 1750,
Right, and so I don't believe in that. I believe in gender-neutral service. I believe if the men want to order first because they're ready, because the women can't make up their mind, great. If the kids want to order first, like, I don't care, but I'm not going to put classifications on it.
Yeah.
Unless the guest chooses.
So say, whenever I'm out with, which is rare, by the way, with parents who have children, it's usually my sister and my nephews, she always orders first for them because it's always, you know, the chicken strips and french fries.
Right. And that's totally fine. And they probably want to get it out of the way so they can focus on what they want to do. I get it.
Right.
And nobody cares. But, you know, it's just something that has always sort of stood in restaurants like, oh, well, ladies go first. Well, why?
Yeah.
Why do the ladies have to go first? Why?
Challenging the norms. So this is a consistent theme in a lot of different organizations. Yeah. It's like, we've always done it this way. Well, why does that mean we have to continue to do it this way? And I'm always encouraging people to push back on that if they have a new idea. And we don't know whether it's a better idea or not until we try it. And if it doesn't work,
yeah,
great.
And I just think it's work, more respectful for everyone. I just, you know, because some women nowadays, specifically, some women do get a little offended, like, well, why am I going first? Like, do you know what I mean? And I know that sounds silly. Like, you know, right, like, we're not solving cancer here. You're going to order a steak from me.
Right.
But yep, it is sort of this thing that was started probably by a man. We don't know how, that the woman has to order first. And in a way, it's very classic and chivalrous. But in another, but nowadays, it seems a little outdated and ridiculous.
Yeah. Let me ask you another culture question about restaurants. Yeah. In particular, the super high-end restaurants, even if they're not Michelin starred, there is an expectation of a certain kind of customer experience. You know, you want it all dialed in. I mean, not to pick on Olive Garden, but you know, you don't expect the same experience at Olive Garden that you do at you know, a really high end Italian restaurant.
But you should see, that's the difference. You should. Good service is good service. I don't care if you're at your local diner. I don't care if you're La Bernardin or something in the middle. Good mm-hmm. service is good service. And the thing is, here's the thing that people don't really realize. Let's say you go to La Bernardin, and the reason I'm picking them is because they were voted the number one restaurant in the entire world, right? They just happen to be in New York, but that's, we'll use them as the top, right? Mm-hmm. The steps of service are all the same. It is the same. It's just that when you're at maybe at Olive Garden or at your local diner, it's a little bit more simplified. And then when you go to a place like La Bernardin, it's more heightened and like there's choreography and there's, but the bones of it, like when you're buying a house, the bones of the house are still the same. They're still good.
Right.
And so it's, you should expect good service. It doesn't mean that you're going to get 4-star service, but you should expect good service, which is just your server being attentive, your water glass never being empty, no debris on the table, having your proper silverware for when your course comes out. I mean, these are all just normal signs of good service that should be relevant to everywhere.
I totally get that. And I don't disagree, because if I get bad service, even at, you know, at any restaurant, it's upsetting and disturbing. And, you know, the least servers can do is be pleasant and attentive, right? Regardless of where it is.
That's it. It's all you need. But I understand your point as well, because when you're going to a higher end restaurant, you're paying more. Let's say you go to a steakhouse, you know, you're paying $60 just for a steak. It doesn't come with anything. That's just the steak. Then you add on the side dishes. Maybe you want an appetizer, then a martini and a glass of wine. You're talking at $200. So it's more frustrating at that level when service isn't good, because you're feeling the pain more.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Because of your wallet. And I get that, but I do believe good service is good service no matter where you go.
Right. And let's talk about how you get the consistency of good service when you've got a whole bunch of people back of the house, front of the house, different shifts, different types of people.
Right.
What have you found is successful in getting a whole bunch of people to deliver not just consistent service, but consistent and excellent service?
Well, that's kind of where you come in, because that's all leadership, right?
Yeah.
So I train servers, runners, bartenders, captains. I train everybody front of the house, right? On the steps of service. So the steps of service, when you start to work at a restaurant, this is how you begin your shifts, right? So from the time a guest is seated at your table, within 30 seconds, they should be greeted. And then after you go and greet them, you introduce yourself, offer them a water preference, would they like a cocktail? Maybe talk about the specials then or not, go away. Like, so it's all these little steps for their entire service.
Mm-hmm.
I can teach anybody that. But if we don't have a leadership staff, if we don't have managers that are constantly following those guidelines and doing constant reminders like, hey guys, remember, serve from the left, clear from the right. If we're not constantly doing these reminders and constant trainings with our leadership team, nobody's going to do anything.
Right.
It'll never change. So it really comes down to leadership. So I guess that's a question for you. How do you make sure that the leadership stays on point and on target with the goal?
Well, I mean, one of the most critical things, I mean, besides the fact that leaders need to model it, so the leaders need to do what they're asking the staffs to do and be the model for what the expectations are, and and leaders need to hold people accountable, to your point. And if they're letting stuff slide, then, you know, then...
And it's anarchy, because that's what's going to happen. Yeah.
Exactly. And so it's interesting because one of the big things that I teach leaders, because it's something leaders can start to do instantly, regardless of what the culture of the organization is, you know, the C-suite culture could be, you know, a little bit, you know, sort of, let's just say, less than evolved. And you know, and really directive and command and control. And I say, you can do things differently on your team. And one of the easiest ways to do that is to develop a culture of feedback on the team. And when executives and leaders and managers in, you know, sort of a typical corporate environment think of feedback, they think of, you know, stopping by a person's cubicle or desk, or, you know, calling them into a meeting, or having it as a topic in their next one-on-one meeting that they have on a weekly basis to get regular feedback. That obviously doesn't work in a restaurant. So I'm just curious,
no.
For good managers or even shift leaders or, you know, whatever the you know, the roles are, what do you see them doing to give continuous feedback when they see something either, you know, constructive or positive to comment on, and you're slammed?
It's tricky in restaurants because the thing is, it really does boil down to management. You can have, because you're always going to have a varied level of skill set in the staff, right? Mm-hmm. The thing about the restaurant industry that I kind of love is that we accept everybody. Like, say you're a teacher and you're off for the summer, you're just going to work for 3 months, right? Yep. So of course, come on in. You have to go in September, fine.
Yeah, I did that when I was in college. I was, you know, in between freshman and sophomore year, I was a hostess at the Red Robin in West Palm Beach.
Right. So there you go. So you have people like yourself, or here in New York and in LA and Chicago, you have a lot of actors that come and go because they book gigs and then they come back. But then you also have a core group of people where this is their profession. And so you have to kind of marry all of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's challenging because if management does not stay on point with it, if management does not constantly remind, because we have a pre-shift meeting before every shift, you always have a pre-shift meeting in a restaurant.
Yep.
That is the moment that the managers can go over, okay, hey, let's talk about some service points. Let's remember to, you know, again, serve from the left, clear from the right. Mm-hmm. Let's remember that the water glass never goes below half. Let's these two things be our goal for tonight. And then what should happen is the managers should, for the night, because that's what they have stated in the pre-shift, that should be what their focus is for the night. And so if they see that someone's not serving left, clearing right, they mm-hmm. should go up to them and be like, hey, I really need you to focus on this. And so once they start really going to the individuals who aren't maybe following suit, if they continue to not follow suit, then that's when the managers sort of have to sit them down and go through that whole process of like, this is a verbal warning. This is how we're going to do things here.
Right.
So I had to tell you 3 times. And if you're not going to do that, then I just want you to know that our next step is a written complaint. And then, of course, your 3rd time after that, you're fired.
Sure.
So you need a team that can do that. Finding a team that can do that consistently is challenging.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. It is.
Well, you know, it's challenging everywhere. And it may be, you know, ever so slightly more challenging in the restaurant environment because, like you said, you're hiring people for whom it's a career and people for whom it's a stopgap measure, and for, you know, people whose real passion is acting and all that. But, you know, I run into it all the time where managers are like, God, I have some people on my team that are rock stars and some people that, you know, just punch the clock and some people who, you know, do everything.
Right.
So I think we see a mix of that. What I love about restaurants and also healthcare, because this is very common on, you know, with nursing shifts and so forth, to have like you call it a pre-shift meeting, and in hospitals they call it a stand-up meetings, but also pre-shift. And it is important to just keep reminding people, because first of all, people have a lot to remember. And that communication to just continue to reinforce those expectations is super important. And I got to say, leader shifters, I don't think we do enough of that in, you know, more of the corporate office type of world. You know, maybe we have a weekly one-on-one with people or a weekly team meeting, but very few leaders are having, setting daily expectations and saying, okay, today the focus is, you know, the 5-foot rule, which is something I read on your blog.
I loved it. The 5-foot rule is my favorite thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'll have you explain that in a minute. You know, and so what sorts of things are you tasking your people with practicing on any given day, especially if it's in a customer facing role? So I love this, taking this idea of a pre-shift meeting out of restaurants into other contexts.
Right. And the thing about the pre-shift is it should be like whatever you're focusing on, like say you start on a Monday, right? So whatever we're focusing on Monday, that needs to be the focus for the entire 7 days.
Okay.
Because you're not going to hit all of your employees in a restaurant.
Sure.
If you just do it 1 or 2 days.
Yep.
Right. Yep. Especially in a restaurant, because a lot of reasons people work in restaurants is the flexibility of schedule.
Absolutely.
And so the problem, what happens is with managers in restaurants is, and I can only speak of restaurants because that's the only industry I know, is they are bogged down with so much work that sometimes they just let things slide, not because they're not good managers, but because they have to deal with inventory because it's the first of the month, or they have to do the payroll for the week, or they have to do financials for corporate that they need. Whatever it is, they have all these other things that they have to deal with. And then on top of managing the staff, once you're in service. Mm-hmm. So sometimes things fall by the wayside just because they're bogged down with responsibility.
Sure.
I'm not saying it's okay.
Yeah.
It's not. It's learning to balance the fact that, yes, I know you have paperwork to do and I know you have to do this. However, if you let restaurant employees sort of do what they want, it's like the lunatics running the asylum.
Yeah,
it is. I have seen it at every restaurant I've worked in. It doesn't matter if it's a Michelin star or if it's a local joint. I've worked in them all. Yeah. It's all the same. We're all a bunch of toddlers. And if you leave us alone, we're going to do what we want. It's the truth. And so that's sort of the biggest thing to overcome. When I was an AGM at a restaurant, as the night would wind down, I mean, I wanted to go home too. I'm no different than my staff. But I would stay on the floor with them to make sure that everybody was doing their closing side work equally. Mm-hmm. And once I saw that that was happening, then I would remove myself and go to the office and do paperwork. But then I would pop back out on the floor without telling them, just to make sure.
Yep.
So they knew that that's who I was as a manager. So they never skirted. They always did their job.
Right.
That's, you actually kind of have to do that. I hate to say it, but you need to make sure, because this way, if you don't do that, what happens is you're always going to have stronger links in the chain at every job, right?
Yep, absolutely.
If you're not, as a leader, on top of that, what's going to happen is the people who are always lazy and just trying to get away without doing work are going to not do it. And the people who are really good and strong at their job are going to take on the lion's share. They're going to get frustrated.
And resentful.
That they have too heavy, yes, and then that's going to create a toxic environment, and either they're going to leave and go find another job, and you're going to be stuck with the people who don't do their job, or it's going to cause interpersonal issues within the culture, right?
Yep.
So that's why leadership is so important, to nip all that in the bud.
Yep. So as you were talking, I just thought of another question, just, you know, sort of as you were saying, like the inmates running the asylum and, you know, people just starting to slack on service.
Yeah.
Online reviews. When I think of who's impacted by that, I think restaurants first and foremost, and lots of different companies are affected by what people say online. It's like the new equivalent of, I'm going to report you to the Better Business Bureau.
Yeah, it is.
And so advice for leaders in any industry about how to respond and mitigate negative online reviews.
Yes. Great question. Because Yelp reviews are problematic. Open table reviews, I have found that restaurants put a little bit more regard into, because they, sometimes with the Yelp reviews, they seem just like a little crazy,
mm-hmm.
right? They don't seem as legitimate. As a leader, what you have to do is you have to really read the review, and you have to really, you can decide whether the review is accurate or not. We know this. Mm-hmm. You can tell when somebody comes in and restaurants, let me put it this way. We pretty much know who's going to leave a bad review before they walk out the door.
Right.
We know this. And so if we have done as a restaurant, everything we can do to make it right, and the bad review still goes in, you do not respond. You don't do anything. You just let it go. Right. The thing is, restaurants want to fix it. And yeah. if you, and this is just a little aside, if you're dining out, anybody who's listening right now, and you're having a bad experience for whatever reason, the food wasn't right, the service is bad, you're not clicking with your server, because that happens. We're all humans. Like sure. we just might not click. Let the restaurant fix it. Like, give them the opportunity to make your experience right, because we want you to be happy and we want mm-hmm. you to come back. If you don't allow the restaurant the opportunity to fix your experience, and then you go write a bad review, it doesn't really do anything except hurt lots of innocent people who didn't give you a bad experience.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So that's first and foremost. Let the restaurant try and fix it. If the restaurant tries to fix it and you still have a bad experience, you want to leave a review, fine. One out of every 100 reviews, if it's like crazy and out of left field, most restaurants ignore it. However, as you're scrolling through these reviews, if you see that there's a theme in the reviews, then you do have a legitimate problem at your restaurant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's when the leadership, the powers that be, need to go in and be like, okay, we keep getting the same review about people feeling rushed. So maybe we need to alter our reservation book. Maybe we don't do reservations every 15 minutes. Let's do them every 30. Maybe we don't rush the steps of service a little bit. Let's readjust. So there is some legitimacy to it if you right. see a theme, but sure. if you just see random, you know, I was working at the Tiffany Blue Box cafe here in the city. I was the opening AGM and people could not get in. It was a 15 table restaurant. It's tiny. People couldn't get in. And because it was breakfast at Tiffany's, people were losing their minds. They would literally come to us crying, telling us that they had to eat here because it was their dream, because Audrey Hepburn, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm not kidding you. And I have 15 tables. I cannot abracadabra a table for you. Like, I can't. And so people would leave bad reviews saying that we were horrible and wouldn't get them a table. So that's not a legitimate gripe because right. you didn't get your way.
Right.
Right. A legitimate gripe is had a reservation. I had to wait 45 minutes. That's a legitimate gripe.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, a lot of times perception is reality. So even if the theme you're seeing, you don't agree with or isn't really legit like that one,
right.
what do you do? To offset
you have to re-examine. You have to examine your practices and your leadership, right? So if you're seeing a theme with all the bad reviews, you have to sit down with your management team and be like, okay, we're getting repeat offenders with the same thing. We have to really examine this. And that's when you have to go in and retool. Maybe it's the seating, maybe it's the reservations. Maybe you're cramming too many people in and the kitchen can't keep up. Because, you know, if you seat your entire dining room within 30 minutes of each other, all of those dupes are going into the kitchen at the same time. The kitchen right. is now going to be weeded and yeah. your food's not coming out. And so those are legitimate things you have to sit down and re-strategize, right. which I would think you would have to do in any business.
Yeah. And I guess I would also think, even if you can't change the way things are done, like you're not going to change the fact that the Tiffany's restaurant only has 15 tables.
No.
Is there a way to communicate differently so you're managing customers' expectations differently, or there's a consistent talk track that anyone who is interacting with a customer, whether it's at the front door or on the phone mm-hmm. or by yes. email, you know, so that you can do whatever you can to make the rejection a decent experience.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. The thing, so yes, we had a script that we came up with of what to say to everyone. And we honestly, I can't tell you how many times during the course of the day that I had to say this, but I would show them, physically show them. I would walk them into the dining room and I'd say, look, there's 15 tables. I'm so sorry I could not give you a reservation today, but I also can't rush the people who did get a reservation and screw up their experience.
Right.
So it's like, I'm damned if I do, I'm damned if I don't. And so I can logically talk a guest through and say, this is why I can't seat you right now. I will do my best to get you in. If you want to hang out and wait, if you have some time to kill, hang out with me. Give me 30 minutes. If somebody doesn't show up, let me try and push you in. Mm-hmm. But that's the best I can offer you. And I think they can see that we sincerely were trying and we're right. Okay. The thing is, you're not, that doesn't always work with everyone, as is life.
Sure.
And that whole, you know, adage that the customer is always right is actually not true.
Right.
You know, the customer is always right until they're not, is yeah. really what it is. And in a scenario like that, if this is a restaurant you're dying to eat at, to come at the management team, the host team with aggression and entitlement is not going to be your best way to get your reservation.
Right. Just like airlines.
Just, yeah. And I think people forget that. People like to throw their weight around, especially in New York, especially at a place like Tiffany's. Well, do you know who I am? Right. And I'm going to go talk to the owner, you know, the CEO. I'm like, great. I can give you his number if you want. Like, I that doesn't work for me because I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're, you know, the Duchess of York, who I have waited on, by the way. Your money is the same color as everybody else's money.
Yeah.
You got a reservation. You didn't. Your reservation is being honored.
Yep.
The end. And I will do what I can to get you in, but you yelling and being entitled is never going to help your situation.
Yeah.
Because this is a little trick I have to tell you that people don't know about reservation systems, like OpenTable and Resy and all that. The restaurant that you're dining at or trying to dine at, we can make notes about you under your reservation.
Right.
And so if you're coming to my restaurant and you are acting badly towards any member of my staff, that goes in under your reservation name. And so the next time you try and get a reservation, you might not be able to get one.
Right.
The reverse is also true. If you come in and you're lovely, if something goes wrong and you handle it with class and grace, not only will we throw free stuff at you, you get a reservation anytime you want.
Yeah, that's like the sort of Four Seasons model where they make notes about other customers. So,
yeah.
You know, when you come back, it's like, oh, Ms. Lepore, welcome back. We've set your room up with you know, the non-down pillows because of your allergies. And there's a Perrier waiting in the refrigerator for you because we know you like that.
Right. No, and that's it. And that's why restaurants make guest notes. They're not making them to be snarky or mean. They're making guest notes because now I know, oh, you're coming back. You are celiac. So I know right away that I can't do bread service for you the traditional way. I'm going to make sure that I have something gluten-free for you, mm-hmm. right? That's really why we do it. But it's also a useful tool because everybody wants to come on Saturday night at 7:30.
Of course.
So if I have one reservation slot left and I have two people and I look at their guest notes and one was lovely and one was wretched, guess who's getting the reservation?
For sure. Yeah.
Right.
Yep. Let's switch gears for a second because
yeah.
there's a couple other topics I wanted to get to with yeah. you. And you know, we can't have two women on a podcast without at least talking about the, you know, women issue, right? Me Too, you know, there've been right. some high profile restaurateurs in the news along with business people. Yeah. And you know, I don't want to go there per se, but you know, it's, you don't have to just have read, you know, the cliche Kitchen Confidential to know it's a rough environment for yeah. women. And yeah. obviously you've made it work. You've succeeded. What's worked for you and what advice do you have for other people who want a career in the business?
So it is rough. And I'm not going to say that it is. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It is rough. It is primarily male dominated. There is still this sort of old school. I mean, I'll out him right now. I don't care. So Chef Alain Ducasse, very famous chef. I waited on him once. He wouldn't speak to me. He wouldn't even look at me. He wouldn't acknowledge me because I'm a woman. He spoke to his companion who was in French and his companion ordered for him to me in English. Wouldn't speak to me, wouldn't acknowledge me. So, but that kind of stuff, I kind of love because when I can see people are going to treat me like that, I don't go away. And so whenever his companion would order to looking at me, I would look directly at Chef Ducasse and I go, oh, so this is what he just ordered for you. Is that actually what you want? Like, I'm not letting him get away with that. Mm-hmm. And so I think as a woman in this industry, you kind of have to have that sort of attitude. Like, no, you're not going to treat me that way. And so this is how you're going to treat me. And I'm not going to let you get away with it.
Right. I'm everybody's equal.
Right. I am your equal. Because without front of the house, you can't have back of the house. And at back of the house, you can't have front of the house. And the chefs that really get that and know that are rock stars.
Yeah.
And are successful.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that. There's that, you know, there are issues with a lot of sexual harassment. You know, everybody knows what happened with Mario Batali, Ken Friedman, and April Bloomfield at the Spotted Pig. If you don't know, please Google it, read about it. Situations like that are difficult because when you read about it and people are like, well, why didn't those women just go get another job? It's not that simple. When you're making really good money, and I mean really good money, I mean, we were talking about this off camera. I know servers in Manhattan that make 80 grand a year,
yeah,
plus full health insurance. So to tell them to just go leave and get another job is not that simple.
Right.
I think as women, we're always people pleasers too, and we're caretakers. And so we try and make things work maybe more than we should. But those women at the Spotted Pig, specifically, they did the right thing. They stuck up for themselves. They went to the powers that be. They went to the owner. They asked for help. They didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came out with it, and good for them. And they made it known to the world as it should have been. You know, that kind of behavior is unfortunately still going on. And that comes back to what we talked about earlier with you. It's leadership. Yep. You know, if a staff member comes to you and says, hey, this man is sexually harassing me, I feel uncomfortable, I feel this is a hostile work environment, you need to nip it in the bud immediately. You don't turn a blind eye, which is what Chef April Bloomfield did, and she let it continue.
Yeah.
And their staff referred to their private room as the rape room.
Oh.
That should never exist. It should never exist in any business ever, ever. I know, I get angry when I talk about this. So again, it comes down to leadership. Your staff, male or female, has to know, because this can happen both ways.
Sure. Right?
Male or female, they need to know that they are safe and they are protected. And if I come to you as my boss, as my manager, as my leader, and I say, hey, I have a problem with this person because this is how they're treating me, you as the leader better handle it.
Yeah.
The end. And yeah. I think if more of that happened, it would certainly cut down on work environment harassment in restaurants.
Yeah.
There's another kind of harassment in restaurants, and that's from the guest.
Yes. I was going to ask you about that.
Yes. And that happens too. And so as a woman, you know, there's always going to be a man who's always going to make some sort of sexual comment. I hate to say, but it's true.
Yeah. Or even
worse. I've lived it. Yeah. Or worse. And I've lived it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. One man did reach out and touch me once. He did put his hand a little too low on my hip. He shouldn't have touched me anyway. By the way, PSA, when you're dining out, don't touch your server. There's no need. Don't touch. I know you love them. You have a great rapport. Don't touch them. You don't know them.
Yeah.
Right? Hands off. So, and I grabbed him by the wrist and I moved his hand and I said, can I help you with something? And I said it loud enough for his entire table to hear him. And he was embarrassed. He went, I'm so sorry. And he backed off. And that was the end of that ever happening again. So, you know, again, moral of the story is women, you need to speak up. You need to hold your own. And if one of your guests is mistreating you, harassing you, speaking to you in a disrespectful way, touching you, you immediately get a manager. Immediately. Yeah. And you say to them, I will not wait on this table. And if you have a management team that doesn't support that and doesn't take care of you with that, then you have to either handle it yourself without getting fired. Because
right.
If it's a really good job with good money, I understand you can't just leave. But you need to find a way to make that work for you if you have a leadership team that won't help you.
Yeah. Yeah.
If there's an HR department, you can go to the HR department. Some mom and pops don't have HR departments. You know, you have to educate yourself on what is proper and what is not proper and know what you can say to get away with to make it stop.
Yep, absolutely.
Which is not the PC answer, but that's the answer if you really want to stay working where you work.
Right. I mean, listen, it's reality. I've worked with some leaders who I've said, you know, a client has been inappropriate and they fired the client. I mean, that's ideally what you want is
you do
to live the deep good values and the values of the organization. And if that's not the case, yeah, you're right. You just got to navigate it yourself.
You have to navigate it carefully for what works best for you in your life situation. I can't speak to that. Because again, there are some jobs that you make so much money. The schedule's amazing. You have great benefits. You need those benefits for whatever reason. And so you're going to try and make it work. So you need to find out what your rights are legally and how to handle it properly if you're not being supported, if that's the job you want to stay in.
Yep, for sure.
Yes.
All right, so I am super excited to ask you about some of the food history stuff.
Yes!
Again, leadership, just we were talking before the podcast, and I bet you didn't know this, and you'll find out more. Every single day of the year is a food holiday of some sort, right? Isn't that what you
Yeah, it is. So, yes. Yeah, so, like, for example, Monday is going to be National Sourdough Bread Day. Great. So I'm always up for a loaf of bread.
I mean, normally, we know, the ones that have turned into big things on social media, you know, cheese day, wine day,
cheeseburger, pizza, all
yes,
that.
Yes, but okay, tell us about the less well-known ones.
And actually, chocolate chip cookie day is coming up. It's in April, just so you know. And that has a cool little history behind it, which I don't want to tell you now, but it has a really great American history. So anyway, I was inspired by all this because I kept seeing this stuff trending like on Twitter, or I would see it on Good Morning America. I was like, what is this national food holiday bullshit? And then it was always associated with a recipe. And that didn't quite ring true for me. And so I did some research, and then I sort of fell down the rabbit hole, and I realized that these all started back in the 1950s with President Dwight Eisenhower. And I think it was through a joint Senate and House resolution, signed a proclamation declaring, I think it was May 8th or 5th or something, National Walnut Day. And that was specifically to bring attention to all of our walnut farmers and growers in California. So you could go out and support our farmers in our country, buy walnuts, make cookies, you know, make Waldorf salads, whatever you want to do. Right. So it was a way to sort of bring attention to the food of America. And so once you fall down the rabbit hole with this, it was really cool stuff that I found out, that all of these national food holidays really, for the most part, all have American history behind it, whether it's presidential or agricultural or geographical or people reaching the American dream, like Milton Hershey, right?
Yeah.
So he's one of my favorites to talk about. You know, everybody knows the Hershey bar, Hershey's Kisses.
Sure.
So Milton Hershey only had a fourth grade education. That was it. Hershey chocolate was his fourth attempt at a successful candy business. First two failed miserably. And they were in New York. And then he moved to Pennsylvania. He started a caramel company called Lancaster Caramels, which is still in business today.
Okay.
But it was when he was looking for something to coat the caramels with that he discovered chocolate. And he sort of fell in love with chocolate. So he sold off Lancaster, and that's when he started Hershey Chocolate. That was his fourth business. And now look at it.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. As somebody with a fourth grade education, look what he's achieved.
Right.
The American dream, right? So it's stuff like that I find really fascinating beyond belief. For some reason, I don't know why, because I hated history in school. But when it's...
Surrounded by food, it becomes more interesting.
I'll eat it. Yeah, it's great.
Well, so, you know, it's interesting, the Hershey story, because what that underscores is something that we talk about all the time, as you know, in the leadership universe, which is you gotta fail, you know, because that's where you learn the most. And it's like how you respond to the failures and pick yourself back up and try again, and not to get discouraged, and carry forward the lessons that you learned. Don't repeat the same mistakes, make new mistakes. But ultimately, some of the most successful people in the history of the world have done it after a succession of failures.
Yeah, and he's a great example of that, because again, fourth grade education, and God bless him, he kept trying, because he knew that this is where he should be. Like, he knew this was his lane. He just couldn't quite get all the pieces of the puzzle together. And so he just kept trying and kept trying. And then, you know, finally, when he got to working with chocolate, as opposed to confections or candies, it sort of all clicked for him. And so that's how we have Hershey. And it's fascinating that there's a lot of history in our country surrounding like the silliest things, you would think, like ice cream sundaes. Believe it or not, there are two cities in this country that fight over who invented the ice cream sundae. I'm not even kidding you. I think it's Ithaca. And there's one other city, and I can't remember where it is, but literally, like, it's like a battle to the death. They both claim that they have proof that their city is where the ice cream sundae was invented. So, like, people get crazy over this stuff, which I think is hilarious. Like, you want to fight over an ice cream sundae? I will take that fight any day over some other ones, right?
Right.
But it's fun to kind of learn about all this stuff, and then also maybe go out and support people that you're inspired by, like Milton Hershey or You know, when we talk about chocolate chip cookies, which are coming up in a couple of weeks, when you see the story about how that came to be, that might inspire you to go out and visit this one specific place, or maybe go buy Nestle chocolate chips, which you'll see. And then even Monday, which is National Sourdough Day, it started in obviously San Francisco with the Boudin family, and they're a family from France, and they were known as master bakers in France. And then they came over, and it was during the gold rush days in California. And one of the miners that they met gave them a recipe for the sourdough starter, which they call the mother, and the rest is history. And now they're famous for their sourdough, and that's how sourdough came to be in San Francisco.
Well, so where could somebody get a list of all of these more esoteric food holidays?
Well, they're kind of all over the internet. Okay. I've done a lot of research to kind of cross research, because sometimes people make them up and they're not actual real holidays. So what happened was the government they had a department back in the day, I think it was in the 50s or 60s, where they would document these things. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to do it anymore. And so they passed it off to something called Chases. And this is a periodical that comes out every year. And the way that started was that they would list all the holidays for newspapers and calendars and things like that. So it's called Chase's Calendar of Events. So Chase now took it over. So they have it all listed. Now you have to buy that. But if you yourself want a national food holiday, you can get one. You can petition, you can fill out your application and send it to Chase's. And then a group of four people in North Dakota sit in a room and they debate it. And they debate it based on whether it will have national relevance, the importance of it. And then if it's agreed, you get a certificate, but you have to pay like anywhere between $2,500 to $4,000 for it.
Interesting.
Well, you know, you'll have a national holiday.
The reason I was asking about where one could find a list is that where my head went with this in terms of, you know, my business is what an easy way to bring some fun and engagement into the workplace by celebrating some of these fun food holidays and
at low
expense. Right. I mean,
yeah,
everybody, you know, let's have a chocolate chip cookie baking contest, you know, for the team on chocolate chip cookie day. And, you know,
you can definitely Google it. They're out there. A few different sites and publications will pop up. I would just cross-reference them to make sure that it's accurate, because like I said, some people make them up because they feel like it. It is a fun thing to do. And we've done this at restaurants I've worked in. Like, all right, it's going to be National Chocolate Chip Cookie Day. Whoever sells the most cookie plates today, you get a prize.
Great. Yep. Exactly.
It's an incentive for selling.
For sure.
Yeah.
Well, good. Well, Krista, this has been so much fun. Appreciate your time. And Leadershifters, I hope you enjoyed some of the analogies between restaurants and food and leadership in the workplace in terms of, you know, the customer experience is primo, and how to...
Yeah.
And then this idea of the pre-shift meetings, and which is essentially just have more regular communication with your people, set expectations, and then follow up and hold them accountable. I don't care where you work. It doesn't just apply to
restaurants. It's the follow-up. The follow-up is key.
Yep. And then, and then some of the tips for dealing with online reviews, since restaurants bear the brunt of it. So take us out with just, how do people find you? How do they reach you? And, you know, a reminder about the URLs and the YouTube channels and all that.
Yeah. So my podcast is called Turning Tables, which will be out very soon on iTunes. You can find me all over social at Krista Lepore. And you can find my National Food Holiday show on YouTube at National Food Holidays with Krista Lepore. And you can go to my blog, which is dinakit.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Leadershifters,
so
ping me if you have comments or you have additional questions at shaney@theleadershiftproject.com. And also, you know where to find us on social media. Until next time, mwah.